This morning's reading is from Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 1 to 16. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you're entering to possess and drives you out before you many nations, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods, and the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. This is what you are to do to them. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles, and burn their idols in the fire. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. The Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other peoples. For you were the fewest of all peoples, but it was because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your forefathers that he brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery, from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He is the faithful God, keeping his covenant of love to 1,000 generations of those who love him and keep his commands. But those who hate him, he will repay to their face by destruction. He will not be slow to repay to their face those who hate him. Therefore, take care to follow the commands, decrees, and laws I give you today. If you pay attention to these laws and are careful to follow them, then the Lord your God will keep his covenant of love with you, as he swore to your forefathers. He will love you and bless you and increase your numbers. He will bless the fruit of your womb, the crops of your land, your grain, new wine and oil, the calves of your herds and the lambs of your flocks in the land that he swore to your forefathers to give you. You will be blessed more than any other people. None of your men or women will be childless, nor any of your livestock without young. The Lord will keep you free from every disease. He will not inflict on you the horrible diseases you knew in Egypt, but he will inflict them all on all who hate you. You must destroy all the peoples the Lord your God gives over to you. Do not look on them with pity, and do not serve their gods, for that will be a snare to you.
Thank you, Pauline. Please do keep that passage open. Luciano Pavarotti said, "When I was a boy, my father, a baker, introduced me to the wonders of song. He urged me to work very hard to develop my voice. Arrigo Pola, a professional tenor in my hometown of Modena, Italy, took me as a pupil. I also enrolled in a teacher's college. On graduating, I asked my father, 'Shall I be a teacher or a singer?' 'Luciano,' my father replied, 'if you sit on two chairs, you will fall between them. For life, you must choose one chair.' I chose one, and aren't we glad he did? He says, 'It took 7 years of study and frustration before I made my first professional appearance. It took another 7 to reach the Metropolitan Opera. And now I think whether it's laying bricks, writing a book, whatever we choose, we should give ourselves to it. Commitment, that's the key. Choose one chair.'" Well, we're thinking this morning about choices, as you've heard from Andy and from Bernie, that God makes choices. Did you know If you're a Christian, God chose you. Why did God choose you? Well, you say, God didn't choose me. I chose God. I chose to follow Christ. It was my own decision of my own free will. Well, if you're a Christian, there was a point in time when you chose to follow Christ. But actually, the Bible makes the point, he chose us. In other words, God was working in your life, causing you to choose him. So Ephesians 1:4 says, he chose us in him before the creation of the world. Did you hear that? God chose you to belong to him before the creation of the world. That's quite something, isn't it? Before the creation of the world, God knew you. He loved you. He chose you. Now, why did God choose you? Was it because you were especially holy or especially clever? God chose the foolish things of this world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. 1 Corinthians 1:27. That's how God operates. He chooses weak people so that he can be glorified in them. So there's no way I've got the strength to follow Christ. But it glorifies God to take a weak sinner like me and to change me. He gets all the glory when it's obvious his power is at work. And that's what Deuteronomy 7 is about. Look at verse 7. The Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it was because the Lord loved you. Why did God choose Israel? Not because they were a great nation, but because they were a small, insignificant group of tribes. God chose them just because he loved them. How should we respond to all this? Three things. God's chosen people must be holy. God's chosen people must be grateful. God's chosen people must be obedient. Firstly, God's chosen people must be holy. Once, as an experiment, Isaac Newton stared at the image of the sun reflected in a mirror. The brightness burned into his retina, and he suffered temporary blindness. Even after he hid for 3 days behind closed shutters, still the bright spot would not fade from his vision. If he'd stared a few minutes longer, Newton might have gone blind. The chemical receptors that govern eyesight cannot withstand unfiltered sunlight. That's a picture of the blazing holiness of God. God's holiness destroys all that is sinful. This partially explains verses 1 to 6. They are very shocking to the modern mind. Some people here remember the Second World War, when 6 million Jews were murdered. In more recent times, there have been other attempts at so-called ethnic cleansing, such as in Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia. Therefore, one cannot read verses 1 to 6 without feeling somewhat troubled. But there's a reason for it. God says in verse 1, when the Israelites enter the land of Canaan, which is their promised land, God will drive out the other nations who lived there. They're listed in verse 1. And didn't Pauline do a very good job of pronouncing them? And verse 2, when the Lord your... I see, I'm not going to say them, I'm just going to miss it out. Verse 2, when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you, what? You are to imprison them? You're to make a peace treaty with them? You're to live quietly alongside them? Verse 2, you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. That's frightening. They're to destroy their enemies. Why? Verse 16 puts it plainly. You must destroy all the peoples the Lord your God gives over to you. Do not look on them with pity. And do not serve their gods, for that will be a snare to you. In other words, if they leave the Canaanite nations alive, they will become like the Canaanites. They'll adopt their practices. Look at verse 6. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. God's people are to be holy. That means they are to be separated from the world. And therefore, they must not make any compromise with God's enemies. See, these Canaanite people worshipped false gods and did some pretty detestable things like child sacrifice and cultic prostitution. And God knew that if the Canaanites were allowed to go on living in the land, God's people would be tempted to become like them. So God says, verse 3, do not intermarry with them. Why not? Verse 4, for they will turn your sons and daughters away from following me to serve other gods. And the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. Don't marry unbelievers, because they will turn you away from following God. Therefore, verse 5, break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles, and burn their idols. Asherahs were female fertility goddesses, and you worshipped them by having sex with cultic prostitutes. So God's people are to show no mercy to God's enemies. And they're to be utterly separate from them. That's what holiness means. How does this apply to us? Which enemies of God are we to show no mercy to? Let me be very clear about this. The enemy we are to show no mercy to is Satan. He is God's enemy, along with all of his demons. There are those who are opposed to Christ in our culture. I think we should show them love, and we should pray for them. Because there was a time when you and I were enemies of God, and Christians showed us love and prayed for us. But Satan and all his demons are irreversibly God's enemies, and we must make no compromise with them. That means we engage in spiritual warfare. We don't go around smashing up altars, but we do pray in the power and authority of Jesus Christ, for God's kingdom to be established, for the rule of Christ to be established, and for the rule of Satan to be overthrown. That's how we oppose God's enemies. And then we take seriously God's command to be holy. Now, a number of years ago, I threw away my telly, and I threw away my CD collection, and I gave up singing because I wanted to be holy. I gave it all up. However, what I discovered was that throwing these things away didn't solve my lack of holiness. I just found different ways to sin. So after a while, I bought another telly and took up music again, although I'm careful how I use these things. The point I'm making is that you cannot become holy by keeping lots of rules. I'm not going to give you rules. I'm just going to tell you, God chose you to be holy. Therefore, be like Jesus. Number two, God's chosen people must be gracious. What is it? Grateful. God's chosen people must be grateful. Excuse me while I have a sip. It's only water. Honest. I may just tell you a little story. Two golfers stepped up to the first tee on the St. Andrew's course at Ardsley, New York. The elder one was a kindly man who played a thoughtful, deliberate game. The younger man was full of pride and impatience. On the first hole, he sliced, lost his ball in the tall grass, I know just how he felt, shot another one and had a score of 8 instead of 4. On the second tee, he began to lecture the caddy. Keep your eye peeled. I'm not here to do your job for you. Thereafter, every bad shot was the caddy's fault. At the end of the first 9 holes, the young man was so enraged that he discharged the caddy and carried his own bag. That caddy doesn't like me, he said to his companion, and I'm sure I don't like him. He made me nervous. Thank God he's gone. After several holes had been played, without a word, the older player broke the silence. Several years ago, a little kid from Yonkers came up here and was taken on as a caddy. He was a wonderfully sweet-natured boy, quick-witted, willing, and had a nose for golf. Everybody liked him. His name was William. He had a club foot. But that didn't affect his quality as a caddy. It was a pleasure to go out with him. A certain famous doctor, a member of the club, became interested in William and took him south on a long trip. When William returned, he went back to caddying. The doctor, however, had to give up golf shortly after that because of his health. He died a few months later. One morning I was playing around with William, carrying my bag. Spring was running riot and the fields and hedges were alive with blossoms. William gathered flowers until he had quite a bouquet. "Who's the girl, William?" I asked. "I haven't any girls, sir," he said sheepishly. "They're for my friend, the doctor. Twice a week, I take flowers to his grave." "You see," the man went on, "the doctor took him down south that winter and operated on his foot. He made the boy whole again, and William never forgot the doctor's act of kindness." "Now that's a caddy worth having," the younger man said. "Whatever happened to this William?" "He carried your bag today for the first 9 holes." William, the caddy, understood gratitude. Verse 7 makes the simple point. God chose his people. That's something to be thankful for, isn't it? There was a minister in Wales who recently died called Derek Swan. I remember Derek telling me when we were together on a conference about the first time Derek understood that God had chosen him before the creation of the world. And it didn't make Derek proud. He didn't think, well, I'm one of the elect. I'm one of the chosen ones. It made Derek weep to realize that Christ loved him and chose to die for him before the creation of the world. Look what God did in verse 8. He brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery, from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. What an extraordinary thing. God's people were enslaved in Egypt. They were desperate. They were utterly ill-treated. And God rescued them. Now the point is, God has rescued you, if you're a Christian. And he hasn't just rescued you from slavery in Egypt. He's rescued you from slavery to sin and death and hell. People without Christ are lost. And God has rescued you. He said, I don't want you to go to hell. I'm going to send Jesus to the cross to die in your place, to take your punishment so that you can go to heaven. You've been rescued. And you know how many Christians react to that? Yeah, whatever. So what? So what? You and I should be grateful. And we should show our gratitude by living for Christ. With every fiber of our being, every moment of the day, with all of our energy. See, I think a lot of Christians think they're doing God a favor by turning up at church on a Sunday. God is looking for an attitude of gratitude. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my life, my soul, my all. Is that your attitude this morning? You're so thrilled with Christ, so delighted to be saved, that you want to serve him, that you want to tell others about him? Now, when I talk about an attitude of gratitude, just remember again, we don't earn our salvation. We don't get to heaven by scoring brownie points. We get to heaven because of God's grace. God's grace means God loving us and blessing us and forgiving us, even though we don't deserve it one little bit. Everything depends upon God. I am saved because of God, from first to last. The Israelites were saved because of God, not because of their own goodness. They were helplessly lost in Egypt. But, verse 8, God made an oath. God made the oath. God promised Moses that he would rescue the people. Know therefore, verse 9, that the Lord your God is God. Everything depends upon God. He is the king. He is sovereign. He is in control of everything. He is working out his purpose. I wonder, do you need to remember this morning that the Lord is God? Maybe you're facing ill health. Maybe you're facing unemployment. Maybe you're facing great anxiety. Maybe you're praying for unsaved loved ones. Know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He can be trusted. You can rest in the sovereignty of God. You can trust God. You can believe God. Cultivate an attitude of gratitude, not an attitude of anxiety. God, I'm so grateful that you've saved me. I'm so grateful that you're on the throne. I'm so grateful that I can trust you. I'm so grateful, Lord, verse 9, that you are the faithful God, keeping your covenant of love to 1,000 generations. I'm so grateful, God, that I'm in your covenant. The covenant was the agreement God first made with Israel, that he would be their God, that they would be his people, and which God renewed when Jesus died on the cross. God says to you, you can be in my covenant. You can be in relationship with me, not because of your own goodness, but because Jesus died for you. And God's chosen people should be grateful for this. Get down on your knees and thank him every day, because he is a faithful God. And those who don't serve him, in verse 10, they're destroyed. So be grateful. Number 3, God's chosen people must be obedient. Look at verse 11. Therefore, take care to follow the commands, decrees, and laws I give you today. See, we've been talking about God's great love in choosing us. In the light of all that, how can we be anything other than obedient? Becca and I both come from loving homes. Our parents have made great sacrifices for us. Therefore, we love them and we want to please them. I want my parents to be able to say on their deathbeds, we brought up a godly son who lived for Christ, because nothing would give them greater joy. How much more then should we obey the God who has loved us since before the creation of the world? Now, here's an important point. If you obey God, you get blessed. Look at verse 12. If you pay attention to these laws and are careful to follow them, then the Lord your God will keep his covenant of love with you as he swore to your forefathers. I'm just going to skim through a couple of things here. If you obey God, you come into the place of blessing. Look at verse 13. He will love you and bless you and increase your numbers. He will bless the fruit of your womb, the crops of your land, your grain, new wine and oil, and so it goes on. Now, we must remember the ultimate fulfillment of this promise is in heaven. So sometimes bad things are going to happen to us. This is because we live in a fallen world. It's just the way things are. But it's a general truth that if you live for Christ, you will be blessed. And ultimately, you'll be perfectly blessed in heaven. For now, we get sick, we have troubles, but we are blessed. It's like fatherhood. I find fatherhood exhausting. People start putting pressure on you from the moment you open your eyes in the morning. There's no end to it. But I wouldn't miss it for the world. I have difficulties, troubles, but I know as a father, I am blessed. And that's how it is in the Christian life. Difficulties, troubles, but yes, we are blessed. Verse 14, you will be blessed more than any other people. Why? Because we know God. What a blessing. We know God. So, an amazing truth. God chose you before the creation of the world, simply because of his grace. Therefore, we must be holy. We must be grateful. We must be obedient. God grant it to us for the glory of Christ. Amen.